Hi, this is Nancy Clare, and welcome to episode 82 of Speaking of Mysteries. Our guest is Barry Eisler, whose latest thriller, The God's Eye View, conjures up an NSA that has developed a program that observes, well, everything, along with an algorithm that can recognize anomalies that could portend acts of violence. The problem is that the power behind this surveillance is more concerned pinpointing individuals who could become whistleblowers and expose the program than he is in stopping those acts of aggression. The timing is always propitious for a good read, but the timing for The God's Eye View is especially so with the ongoing controversy over the court order Apple received to create a backdoor through its iPhone encryption. I'll let Barry Eisler talk about that. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. I'm very excited that our guest today is Barry Eisler, whose The God's Eye View was released February 9th, am I correct?
February 2nd.
February 2nd. Oh, God, I really am behind the curve on this one. And it's interesting because it's a story about assassins and mass surveillance and whistleblowers and intrepid reporters. And steamy sex. So my first question is, why do you think people engage with thriller fiction on this subject, which is total surveillance, but start to yawn at the news reports of actual encroachment that's going on? And we'll talk about Apple in a second.
Sure. Well, I think it's probably because in the novels you have the steamy sex.
It's that simple.
It's an interesting question. I guess it's always about the presentation, right? So people's minds, I think, are naturally, the human mind is naturally wired to be receptive to a storytelling framework. We tend to care more about who than we care about what. And so there may be one built-in natural advantage to dealing with political issues in the context of a novel, which is you can do it in a way that involves characters people will relate to. Either they'll love them or hate them, but they'll care within the context of a story. Whereas if something is presented just in the news, people may have, at least some people may have, a little bit more of an attitude of, well, what does this really have to do with me? And in fact, that what does this really have to do with me rubric is part of what I see as a fundamental problem in getting people to understand and appreciate the actual threat of bulk population surveillance, because the typical soundbite in response is, what do I have to hide? I mean, I'm an open book. I'm boring. I don't care if the government wants to turn on the video phone on my monitor or hack my iPhone or my computer or whatever, let them. I'm boring. I don't have anything to hide. And as Edward Snowden himself has said in response to that, saying if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear is a lot like saying if you have nothing to say, you don't have to care about the First Amendment. It doesn't make any sense, using your own circumstances as some kind of stand-in for what is for what's right for society. It's a really weird, and if you think about it, narcissistic way of looking at the world, beyond which is the fact that even these people who say, oh, I have nothing to hide, I don't care, anytime you respond to that by saying, would you mind then sending me the passwords to your social media accounts? I just want to look through them. I won't actually publish anything. For some reason, people are always reluctant to do that. So it does seem that people really do have not something to hide, but things that they prefer to keep private. It's just part of human nature.
Well, actually, you anticipated one of the questions that I had, which was sort of coming from the other direction, is, and you've given it, but you know, I was going to ask, what is the answer when law enforcement or government says something along the lines of, you know, if you have nothing to hide, right, then why should surveillance bother you? And you answered that question. It's sort of like, well, I don't really want you to.
Sure.
Hear what I'm saying.
Exactly. The framework is deliberately misleading, or at least it's ignorantly misleading, and a moment's thought reveals how silly it is. Why do we have locks and doors on our bathrooms and our bedrooms? Why would we start talking differently at a dinner party if somebody pulled out a dictaphone, put it on the table and said, hey, this is a really interesting conversation. If you guys don't mind, I'd like to just record it so I could listen to it later because I find it so interesting. We would start talking differently. We would be more careful about what we said, less free in what we would be willing to express. We would start to self-censor. Everyone knows this if we just think about it a little bit. We have private lives. It's just an innate part of being human. And to create an environment where the government is capable of monitoring everything we do in electronic environments, everywhere we go in the physical world, everyone we talk to, everything we buy, every internet site we visit, of course that's going to have a profound effect on the way we live our lives as free people and as human beings. A child would understand this with only a moment's reflection, and that soundbite, well, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to lose, is an attempt to get around that common sense reaction to suppress it.
Well, it is a bit Orwellian, and as you pointed out, and of course, you know, this is a very, very big part of your novel, this all surveillance all the time. But as it turns out, that's not enough. Because just in the past 2 days, the FBI has asked Apple to create a back door. So either they can't find the emails and the phone calls that the San Bernardino terrorists made, or they just look upon this as a really good excuse, for lack of a better word, to get a backdoor key that will essentially open everybody's iPhones.
That's the idea.
And that's the idea, and yet you have very serious-minded people saying, these are terrorists we're after.
Yes.
These are, you know, that this outweighs, you know, it's a little like, you know, freedom of speech, except you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. This is preventing someone from yelling fire in a crowded theater. We just want to keep you safe, and it sort of gets you to the point of, at what point is guaranteeing our safety going to kill what we're trying to protect?
Yeah, it's funny that you bring up the analogy of yelling fire in a crowded movie theater, because that that example from a free speech case called Brandenburg v. Ohio is so widely misunderstood and misapplied. Actually, with that case, if it stands for anything today, it stands for the fact that there are historically only the most limited exceptions to the broad constitutional guarantee of free speech. And almost every time that example is brought up, it's brought up in the following illogical, inapplicable way. People say, well, free speech is not an absolute right. After all, you can't, and really, what's this? You can't falsely yell fire in a crowded movie theater, right? Therefore, there must, this other exception that I want to free speech should also be applicable. You hear this in the context, for example, of hate speech, right? People like, I mean, what's his name? One of the Cuomo nepotistic brothers, Chris Cuomo, who's a CNN commentator, a Fordham Law School graduate, actually tweeted a year or so ago that the Constitution doesn't protect hate speech. And he got, and he did it in a really sneering, condescending way, that followed it up by saying something like, the Constitution, don't just love it, read it. And he got pummeled on Twitter for his ignorance. The Constitution absolutely does protect hate speech. There's no exception to the First Amendment with regard to hate speech, and there's never been any sort of judicial precedent along those lines. Anyway, so the notion that just because you can't falsely yell fire in a crowded movie theater, and because of some very narrowly tailored exceptions to free speech, such as fraud or speech inherent in criminal conduct or imminent incitement, those are pretty much the only exceptions.
Yeah, violent overthrow of the United States government.
Yeah, even that actually is permissible. It would have to have something to do with imminent incitement. You can totally say, I think there should be a revolution, and that would be protected speech. So So the fact that there are a very few extremely narrowly tailored historical exceptions to free speech, most people think that means that, okay, so that we should and do in fact have other exceptions, like an exception for hate speech. But here's the thing about encryption. I should say I'm far from any kind of encryption expert, although I have a few friends and acquaintances who are real experts.
We'll get into that later. Friends and acquaintances.
Okay. And what the government is asking Apple to do is not just a problem because of the result that we would see. And the result would be that anything that is protected by encryption right now would thereafter be unsafe. And if you think about what anything means with regard to the internet, we're not just talking about the texts you send with your boyfriend or girlfriend, or the photos you took at the beach, or the classic propagandistic exception. People are like, "Oh, you know, the government has no interest in in the letters you get from your grandmother." That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the entire internet, including, for example, everything having to do with e-commerce. If encryption is made insecure, then e-commerce itself becomes insecure. That's a huge part of the economy. It's just something we ought to think about as a cost of creating a backdoor. What people don't understand is a backdoor for one party is a backdoor for all parties. It's impossible, at least unless someone figures out a way to suspend the laws of physics, it's impossible for Apple or anyone else to create a backdoor for the U.S. government that will not also be exploitable by any other government, including various enemies du jour like China, Russia, Iran, you name it, as well as various criminal and hacker groups. You can't make the internet less secure with regard to one potential attacker without making it less secure with regard to all potential attackers. And that's something that needs to be understood. And anyone who's listened to this, hey, if you have any doubts, don't take my word for it. Even Michael Hayden, former director of the CIA and of the NSA, made these same points in a conversation with a Wall Street Journal reporter just the other day. You can find it on the internet. I'll actually be talking to Hayden at a meeting of the Association of Former Intelligence Officers in San Francisco on February 29th. Anyone who's curious, you can find out more about it on my website. Anyway, so that's the problem with the result that the government is looking for there. Government is trying to make the internet less secure with regard to the U.S. government, but in doing so, it could only result in making the internet less secure with regard to all potential attackers, including a lot of unsavory groups. But it's not just the outcome that should concern us here. It's also the process. The government isn't demanding that Apple turn over, say, documents that are currently in its possession. What the government is fundamentally demanding here is that Apple redirect its workforce to some project that the government wants them to work on. There is no precedent for this. And that's why Donald Trump's off the top of his head soundbite that why is Apple setting itself above the law is so nonsensical. Apple's not setting itself above the law. It's saying there's no applicable law that would allow the government to do this. This is like coming into a company and taking control of the workforce and redirecting it to some new government project at the government's whim. I mean, the government can't just show up at my door and say, "Hey, Barry, I want you to go to the apartment building across the street and clean all the windows." Can't do that. You could do it maybe as some sort of punishment for a crime or something, community service. But you can't just dragoon someone into doing work that you, as the government, want done. And that's fundamentally what the government is trying to do when it says Apple has to have its engineers create this new backdoor.
It's that whole due process thing. You know, it's so inconvenient when you...
Isn't it, though? I know. Yeah. And it's funny that you say that because even more than the Fifth Amendment, it's hard to imagine that the Fourth Amendment, if it were being considered today as a constitutional amendment or even just as legislation, if it didn't exist and it were coming up in Congress as legislation, that the people will be secure in their persons and effects and the government has to have some sort of probable cause and a warrant before it can examine those papers, persons and effect. In today's political climate, you could never get legislation like that passed. It's worth considering.
You could go back to the First Amendment, but before we go down this primrose path of dalliance towards like Donald Trump and all that, I mean, my head might explode, your head might explode. It wouldn't be pretty. you know, it's funny. When I saw the kerfluffle over Apple, and I don't mean to use such a trite word, but it's just, it's so huge. It's almost like you can't overestimate how big something like this is for all the reasons that, yeah, that you described. Yeah. But going back to your book, going back to the God's eye view, it reminded me a little bit of when Guzman escaped the week that Don Winslow's book, The Cartel, came out.
Oh, I haven't read it yet. I loved Power of the Dog, and I've Don's fantastic. I got to read The Cartel.
You really do have to read The Cartel, but of course the funny thing is The Cartel opens with the Guzman-esque character escaping from prison.
Right.
And so Don Winslow gets to have his sound bites, and he's so well spoken and is so wry and excellent at this. I'm just wondering if you're going to be called on to weigh in on this, because it, in some ways, is very similar. It's something that I'm sure Theodore Anders, who is the character in your book who runs the NSA, would love to have the backdoor key to everybody's smartphone.
Of course.
He's got everything else. And yeah, so we should explain, in the God's Eye View, the NSA has come up with a program that can evaluate in real time everything. Is that a pretty good?
Yeah, I think that's good. It's not so specific that it would be a spoiler, but yeah, it gives you an idea of the kinds of consequences in the book, for sure.
And he during this, without a spoiler, during this, he discovers something, because he is privy now to everything, and the algorithms that will through which anomalies will pop up, and he can examine those anomalies. He sees an anomaly and he doesn't like it. So he would love, though, how much easier it would be just to have the encryption key to everybody's smartphone. Wouldn't that be handy?
Of course.
But one of the things, and you mentioned Snowden. One of the things I noticed in the book was that Theodore Anders methodically describes to his second in command how he is going to discredit somebody if he or she becomes a whistleblower.
Right.
And how he is going to work the media by dangling access and spoon feeding these pre-digested bits to the lucky journo that he chooses. And I got to say, having been a journalist who's covered celebrities, it reminds me how celebrities and their PR people handle the press.
Of course. It's the same dynamic. It's all about access and doing what you need to do to get the access and to make sure that nobody cuts you off from the access. That's why access journalism is inherently untrustworthy. It's impossible to get honest coverage from someone whose job depends on being held in favor by the people he or she is covering. I mean, a child would understand this. Only in our sophisticated beltway environment can such an obvious law of physics level thing be obscured to the point where people don't have to see it anymore.
Director Anders does this to a couple of the characters that he's talking about. And it does echo NSA's reaction to Edward Snowden, who was initially called a low-level flunky and then was called mentally unstable before narcissist. He was called a traitor. And
yeah, narcissist was the real.
Oh, did I forget narcissist? Word. I'm so sorry.
No, that's right. Okay. They called him a lot of things, but the government was pretty effective, in part because the Washington Press Corps is so promiscuously willing to do the government's bidding. But yeah, the government was intent on painting him as a narcissist, which is, well, whatever, give a long answer, but just briefly, it's fascinating to consider that So we've got a guy, forget who it is, we just have a single person, an individual, who reveals, at a minimum, really disturbing allegations about vast programs of secret government population surveillance. A Martian would probably expect a lot of journalistic coverage of the programs that individual revealed, right? But the Martian would be surprised because so much of the establishment media was not at all concerned about the allegations. Allegations, by the way, which have subsequently been proven to be true by various federal courts. These programs are, in fact, illegal and unconstitutional. But at the time, let's just call them allegations. A Martian would be surprised because so many journalists, so-called, weren't interested in the allegations of vast governmental criminality. They wanted to talk about the motivations and psychodynamics of the person who revealed all of that government criminality. What does that set of priorities reveal about the people who hold those priorities?
Well, and then there's, you know, and we touched on this earlier, the lengths that our intelligence agencies, and we should mention that you were an employee of the CIA, you worked for the CIA, you were a covert operations.
Right.
Our intelligence agencies have taken it upon themselves to keep us safe.
Right.
And, you know, I just get the feeling that we're in danger of killing the thing, our freedom, that we're so determined to protect. I mean, are we protecting democracy to death?
Yeah, I think two things come to mind. The first is what we were talking about a minute ago with regard to Apple. So if Apple were to do what the government wants it to do, it wouldn't enhance national security. It would undermine it. In addition, there's a more general way to look at what's happened to America post 9/11, before 9/11 too, but especially post. And it's this: you can analogize America's reactions to stateless terrorism and the possibility of stateless terrorism to the reactions of a body in producing a fever in response to a pathogen. I mean, the pathogen itself might not be all that. It might be something entirely survivable by the body. The body doesn't really know, and sometimes it overreacts. Sometimes the body produces a fever that gets so out of control that the fever itself begins to produce a threat to the body far greater than whatever threat the pathogen itself might have ever been able to produce. And that's how I look at America post 9/11. We have so little to fear from stateless terrorist groups, really so little to fear. Yes, if some of these stateless terrorist groups ever got their hands on a nuclear weapon, then they would probably use it. That's the big fear, and that's the sort of legitimate fear that our intelligence and other efforts should focus on. But the notion that some relatively random terrorist killings pose any kind of a national security threat is insane. Or at best, to be kinder, it's just ignorant. I mean, you had Roger Cohn, a New York Times columnist, a month or so ago. And this is supposedly the gold standard of opinions and punditry, right? Writes for the New York Times. And he called ISIS, quote, an existential threat to America. So I think the kind thing to say about Roger Cohn is, oh, he just doesn't know what existential means. He should look it up in the dictionary, which seems like a fairly low-level requirement to impose on a New York Times columnist, but whatever, maybe he just doesn't know what existential means. But I think he does. I don't think it's that he's ignorant of the meaning of the word. I think it's that he's so hopped up on fear and he's so bought into the propaganda, and the New York Times sells more papers and people are afraid, that people like Roger Cohn have actually persuaded themselves that this stateless terrorist group that operates exclusively in Syria, Iraq, and now Libya, because the West destroyed Libya and has created some safe havens for ISIS there, is now threatening the very existence of the United States of America. I mean, that's the kind of thing people need to work out in therapy, not on the opinion
pages.
Well,
but maybe it is, as you mentioned, that he's afraid that we'll become so obsessed with it and we will give up our freedoms so readily that we will end up killing ourselves, or maybe
I wish that had been the column he'd written, but alas, no, it wasn't the fever he was talking about, it was just the pathogen.
Suspension of disbelief is one of the magical things about fiction, I think, and But after I finished your book, I had that sensation of a story well told. And then I thought, holy moly, this may be fiction, but it might not always be fiction. Right.
I don't think it's fiction. I think if you look at the level of technology, if you look at the way that technology has been deployed to date, through largely, although not exclusively, the Snowden revelations and reporting based on those revelations. And if you look at the history of government programs like COINTELPRO, and for anyone who's listening, if you don't know about COINTELPRO, just Google it. It's really eye-opening. It's spelled, it's short for Counterintelligence Program. So COINTELPRO, COINTELPRO. Look it up. This is a program of domestic spying, sabotage and subversion aimed at anti-war groups from the, this is the 50s through the 70s, primarily under the J. Edgar Hoover FBI, a program aimed at anti-war groups, student groups, civil rights leaders, even a couple of senators, including Frank Church, who wound up chairing the Senate hearings that dismantled COINTELPRO, or more likely just drove it into another part of the government and got it renamed. But regardless, the sorts of things I'm writing about in The God's Eye View aren't historically unprecedented, not even in America. Forget about other countries. Forget about the Stasi, that sort of thing. It's not unprecedented at all, even in America. And so if you look at all those things together and you have a somewhat cynical take on human nature, although I like to think that, what's that saying? That quality of seeing things as they really are is called cynicism by those who have not got it. So that's my take on human nature. And when I look at, when I apply that take on human nature to all those other things, history, technology, and deployment, I'd be surprised if the things I write about in The God's Eye View don't exist.
And of course, you do have an appendix following the book where you point out the things that are not fiction.
Yeah, which
if
is...
If you really want to get scared, I should tell readers, if you really...
It's been gratifying for me. A lot of the response to the book focuses on how people feel when they come to the list of sources at the end. Because if you don't follow this stuff closely, and I do, partly because of just personal interest, and partly because obviously it becomes fuel for my day job as a novelist. But if you don't follow this stuff super closely and you're exposed to it for the first time in a thriller novel, the understandable reaction would be to say, wow, that was a really entertaining read, but yeah, no way the government is even capable of doing things like that, let alone actually doing them. And I want people to know, no, the government is not just capable of doing those things, but is in fact actually engaging in those things. Don't take my word for it. Take the word of various whistleblowers and the journalists who report on their revelations.
I watched your video interview with Kirkus, and I thought they did a really good job with that.
Yeah, that came out well.
One of the questions you were asked is if you felt you placed yourself in danger with your novel. So maybe you don't, and you answered no. So maybe you don't feel like you're in danger. But I'm wondering if you've ever received a phone call or had something flagged. When I take it, your books are reviewed by the CIA before you publish.
No. My position is that I'm writing fiction, and therefore it's not subject to pre-publication review.
Oh.
And the CIA may take some issue with that. And in fact, in connection with, I'm trying to remember now because it's been quite a few years. It was my fourth book, maybe the fifth. One of my friends from my CIA class, who's still with the organization, pretty high up now, as you would expect, right? I mean, it's been now, oh my God, it's been 27 years since we went in. But anyway, so I've got a friend who's still there, and he invited me to come to headquarters in Langley and give a talk. And I thought, and this would be part of the book tour for the fourth book. So of course I was excited to do that because, come on, how many people do a book signing at CIA headquarters, right? But that'd be great. And shortly after it happened, I got a letter from the PRB, Publication Review Board, saying, hey, what's going on? We haven't seen this book. You got to send us a copy. And I wrote back to them and said, look, my position is that you don't have any right to see a copy. It's fiction. But as a courtesy, I'd be happy to send you one. But you need to understand that I'm working in the private sector. I have deadlines. I can't do this on government time, right? If you have any concerns and you want me to consider them, you'll have to get back to me in some sort of reasonably prompt fashion. And I never heard from them again. That was the end of it.
The question I've asked a couple of other CIA turned novelists is if you've ever received editorial suggestions on plot and or characters. And one of the writers I spoke to said, actually, yes. I sort of see these people sitting there in Virginia, you know, all thwarted editors.
It's funny. I've never received any kind of official guidance or suggestions or demands or anything other than that one letter saying, hey, you got to submit your book for PRB review. But I do have it on reliable authority that I have numerous fans at the CIA and on the National Security Council, and I don't know what they make of my books. Maybe they're just reading them for the sex scenes, but it would
steamy sex. It's like
exactly
you said.
It's the common denominator in all these things. It's nice to think though that maybe there are a few people in the government who might read my stories and just come away questioning a few orthodoxies. That would be, I don't want to flatter myself too much. It's nice to think so, and who knows?
Well, I think you certainly can flatter yourself in the hope that that would happen, and then maybe reality will set in, and the likelihood of that, because we've talked about narcissism and
right,
hubris.
Right.
I wanted to ask a couple of questions about characters that you had in the book, and it goes to sort of a nurture versus nature. You have one character who was abused as a young man, and one who was probably just popped out a sociopath.
Yeah, that's exactly how I think of it. Yeah.
Does the government do its best to take advantage of people like that in recruitment? If you're unlucky enough to be a sociopath, can you hope for a good job and a pension?
Sure.
I mean, I say that a little bit tongue in cheek, but
sure you can. Ask any past president or senator.
but I actually found that as disturbing as anything else, because it's a calculated calculated way of taking advantage of someone's disadvantage.
It's nice that you keyed on that. Thank you. And by an interesting coincidence, I got a Facebook message the other day, I think yesterday or the day before, from a novelist I have long admired, both for his novels, which I really enjoy, and for the work he does on behalf of protecting children. His name is Andrew Vax.
Oh, Andrew Vax. Yeah, I'm in awe of him.
Yeah, he's a really impressive person. And I've been reading his books since I was probably about 25 years old. So it's just a really good feeling in a lot of ways to be in touch with him now and to have him reading my books. It's amazing. Anyway, so he posted something on my Facebook page where he said he was really loving the book, and said, and your depiction of, it's a psychological term, now I'm forgetting it because I hadn't heard it and I found it on Wikipedia, something about attachment disorder. He said, your depiction of how someone takes advantage of attachment disorder was spot on. And I thought, well, I think I know what he's talking about. I don't know what attachment disorder is. So I looked it up, and it's just what you're talking about. It's what happens, and I think Andrew would be more familiar with the phenomenon in the context of children who, for whatever reason, were unloved or abused or neglected, and then become adults who are trying to find that unconditional love that they didn't have as children, and that can lead to a lot of problems later in life. especially if you run into someone who exploits that need. So that's madness in many ways. I mean, this guy had, he had one good thing in his life growing up, one ally, one source of unconditional love, and that was his mother. But his abusive alcoholic father killed her in front of Manus's eyes. Manus, without giving too much of his backstory away, wound up growing up in the system, in the state, in juvenile facilities, where he was further traumatized. So this is a guy who, deep down, is in search of someone who loves him, believes in him, gives his life some sort of meaning, some safe haven. And the director, whether unconsciously or deliberately, saw an opportunity to fill that void and turned Manus, kind of rescued Manus from the system, but only so that he could repurpose Manus toward his own ends. And yeah, anyway, so I think
see, you're right. I read that Anders was intentional, that he sought him out and was intentionally manipulative.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. I mean, you know, is Anders familiar with attachment disorder as a phrase? I don't know the
as a phrase, but you know, leaders, especially since he had been in the military,
right?
Know how to, you know, you look for weaknesses and strengths, and
absolutely,
and that's how you manage. You know,
absolutely,
that's, especially if you're Machiavellian, and he's
that's
rather
right.
Machiavellian.
Yeah, some of these techniques are taught at the CIA. They have to do with asset recruitment and management. You look for vulnerabilities. You look for aspects of personality that can be exploited. And, of course, that all sounds really sounds terrible to say it out loud, and it sounds a little like a little ninja, like, ooh, the government teaches these techniques. But if you think about it, these are techniques that all of us have. We're born with some level of capacity for these techniques. We want certain things from other people. Certainly salespeople are adept with these techniques, and some people just have an instinct for them. Sometimes it can be a kind of healthy instinct in terms of looking for a win-win solution, or it can be an exploitive instinct. And yeah, I agree with you. I mean, someone like Anders, whether he's consciously able to articulate it or not, doesn't really matter. The point is he sees someone like Manus and just intuitively understands how he can take advantage of Manus' condition and turn Manus, exploit him for his own ends.
Which, of course, makes a very human undercurrent to the story about, which involves a lot of technical surveillance and phones and, you know, following people and exotic locations and steam effects. But it was one of the things that I found in reading the book, one of the most interesting and one of the things that I connected to, especially the idea of the lengths a mother would and should go to protect their children.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that I found, and I also found that very real.
Thank you.
You know, balancing all the things that working mothers have to balance, as one of your characters has to do, it really rang true. I mean, regardless of whether she works for the NSA or if she worked for the CIA or if she worked for Walmart, these are all things that she would consider, you know, moving forward as she moves forward with what she feels she should do versus what she needs to do to protect herself and her child.
So. Thank you for that. That's, if I got that right, I'm really happy. That dynamic of love for another beyond concern for the self is something I find so moving. One of the most amazing things about humanity, like that's just humanity at its best for me. And I lost my own mother when I was relatively young, not Manus's age. And it's funny when I see like that kind of fierce maternal love depicted in stories, I find it so overwhelmingly moving. I don't know if you ever did you ever see the movie Searching for Bobby Fischer?
Oh yeah.
Oh my God. Joan Allen, I love her. When she says to her husband something like Joe Montana, she says something like you, and I forget the name of the Ben Kingsley character, the coach who was so hard on her son to try to develop his talent. She says something like, you and whatever his name is, Ben Kingsley, you think that Josh is weak, but he's not weak. He's decent. And if either of you or anyone ever tries to beat that out of him, I swear to God, I'll take him away. Oh my God. Every time I even think about that, it just makes me tear up. It is so amazing. So yeah, anyway, if I got that right at all with Evie and Dash, thank you. I'm glad.
Are you working on something now? Are you working on a novel, and when, and what can you tell us about it?
Yeah. I'm working on a novel that I'm so excited about that it actually temporarily bumped another novel that I'm also excited about and that I had already started outlining when my wife Laura and I started as a kind of almost goofy conversation on a drive down to LA this summer. And we started off joking like, oh, well, you know, it would be this, it would be that, just like an idea for a character. And then we started talking about it more and more seriously. And for the next 3 hours on that drive, all we did was block out who this character is and what motivates her and all this stuff. And I got so fired up about this character and her story that I set aside, I've never done this actually, I set aside the book I had already started outlining and set to work on the new one. So it's so early that I just wrote a pitch. It's funny that you asked. Now, where is that thing? I should open it, and then I could, here's my pitch. Like they asked me to pitch my book in one or two sentences.
Your elevator speech.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, this probably be at least a 2 or 3 floor journey, but you know, I throw a few commas and semicolons in. Anyway, so what's this book about? It's about a Seattle sex crimes detective trafficked to America from Thailand as a child, searches for her sister and for the men who kidnapped and raped them both while attempting to hide from the force that she isn't just investigating sex crimes. She's avenging them.
Nice.
Thank you.
Nice.
She is so awesome. I love her. I cannot tell you how much I love this character. It's just overwhelming to me, and I'm really excited about this.
But this almost sounds like she might turn into a series.
Yeah, she will. It's funny. She's just far too awesome just to be in one novel. She is really, we're talking about some of the psychology, like attachment disorder and that sort of thing. I could talk about this book at great length, and I won't, but because there's for a variety of reasons, but including, you know, I'm sure you have better things to do. But I'll just say this: like, her psychology interests me so much. I read a great book years ago, which I highly recommend, called "On Killing: The Psychological Costs of Learning to Kill in War and Society." It's by a guy named Colonel Dave Grossman. It was nominated for a Pulitzer. It's just an amazing book. Anyway. In the book, he talks about how you can divide people into wolves and sheep, like predators and prey. And most people obviously are sheep, but then there are these wolves out there. But Grossman says there's a third category. And that third category you can think of as sheepdogs. They have fangs like wolves, but their instincts are totally different. Their instinct isn't predacious, it's protective. They want to protect the sheep with their fangs. And Livia is a born sheepdog. It is so hardwired into her. But the trauma she and her sister endured as children it can't change her wiring at the fundamental level. She's always a sheepdog. But the direction that trauma takes her in is so fascinating for me. I just love her. I really love writing this book.
If you turn it in on March 30th, we can look forward to it probably about this time in 2017.
You know what? Actually, the reason I'm working so hard to get it to Thomas and Mercer by March 30th is so that they can publish it in October. So you're going to see it soon.
And then you can come back on Speaking of Mysteries and talk about it.
I would totally enjoy that. And it would be fun to do. To compare how I talk about the character now while the book is in progress to how I approach it when the book is published.
Sounds like a deal. I'm going to hold you to it.
Okay. That'll be easy to hold me to.
Thank you, Barry. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you, Nancy. It was really a pleasure to talk to you.